Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage, how things are and how they got that way. Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller, and with me is Professor Fred Milan. His field is human ecology. His specialty is cold adaptation. The work involves anthropology, archaeology, physiology, and several other ologies to study and interpret how the environment affects the patterns of northern life.
When you talk about the native peoples of Alaska, you're talking about peoples who really are different linguistically, culturally, and racially. That is, they include Eskimos and Athabaskan Indians, and Tlingit Haida Indians, peoples of this nature, Aleuts. And they are different one from each other, and their biggest similarity, perhaps, is their very long relationship to the land.
Is it, what kind of a relationship is it?
Well, I guess what the best way to describe it would be an intimate relationship with the land, with the environment. They were very close to the environment.
It's not an adversary relationship.
No, it's not an adversary sort of relationship. What we try to do is to isolate ourselves from the environment. And I think what they did, and still do many places, is to become well integrated with the environment. And one must, I think, admire these people for having lived in these harsh places for so long a time.
Where does the talent, the genius, the stuff that makes people want to be able to survive in this kind of climate come from?
Well, I'm not really sure I quite understand that question, but my answer to it would be, if you talk to a lot of native people, for example, I've known native people for the last 20 years in one particular community on the north slope of Alaska. You talk to them, they like it there. I mean, they really like it. This is where they live and where they grew up. And if you look at Eskimo language, the word for man, Angun, and the word for hunter, Angunyakti, it's the same. And if you say, I will hunt Angunyaktua, I'm going to hunt, but that means I'm going to reaffirm my manhood. And this might be some sort of relationship, because this is what they do. This is what the men do. They hunt. However, one should point out that the demography shows, the census data shows, that a lot of young women, at least in the period 1970-75, were leaving these communities, were moving from these communities down into the urban centers like Fairbanks or Anchorage.
But why just the women, you said?
Well, I think it's easier for them.
And because they don't hunt.
Well, this is one of the reasons, but traditionally women have been much more socially mobile around the world than men.
How do you figure that? I'm thinking of the woman's place being in her home and being chained to the family for most of her life.
Yeah, well, my impression is that the native women really worked very hard. And I think when they go to school and they see a different lifestyle and running water in the bathrooms and things of this nature, and they see that non-native people come up here and they seem to have the better type jobs, more money, and perhaps it's for this reason that these girls leave the villages and marry non-native people.
And then the men stay there for what reason?
Well, the men stay there, I think, because they feel very competent and capable to deal with the environment and with its ecological resources. That's one reason. However, I think the Alaska Land Claim Settlement Act which gave these communities a certain amount of money, has kind of encouraged a fluorescence of ethnicity. That is, the people are proud now to be Native people, whereas before they weren't. And this money in these communities has kind of encouraged these communities to exist. There's a reason for the kids who were educated in high schools and colleges to come back to their hometowns and work.
And part of what the kids are learning in schools and in colleges, they're taking, I'm sure, business courses and things that they can come back to and use, but you said they're also interested in their roots and their background. They're taking anthropology and they're taking human ecology. What are they going to be learning from those things? What can you teach?
What can I teach? Well, I can teach them about the prehistory, their prehistory, their relationships, how they are related as people to other peoples in the world. I can teach them something about their language and what their language does and how explicit it is for dealing with their environment and their location. I can teach them something about their biology, something about their demography, their nutrition. Can point out to them where I think they should themselves make changes using this kind of information.
Is there a different biology for northern people? Are there adaptations? Are there differences?
Well, the best way I can answer that is there is evidence of a lack of adaptation. For example, in the Eskimo population, that has shifted from its subsistence diet, subsistence lifestyle, to a store diet. There is evidence of an absence of an enzyme, lactase, which is involved in the digestion of milk. But this is not all that strange, because that same enzyme is lacking in Australian Aboriginals and in Laps. As an enzyme which splits milk into two parts, and if you don't have it, you suffer from what's called lactose malabsorption, and you get a stomach ache, and you get what is called fermentative diarrhea. Well, Eskimos don't have that enzyme. At least 75% of them don't seem to. They're also suffering from a lack of another enzyme, which is called sucrase. And this is involved in the digestion of sugar. And possibly they are lacking some enzymes involved in the digestion of starch, amylase. Now, these are sort of, in a way, kind of maladaptations.
Well, they aren't suffering, though, from those until they start changing.
Changing diet, yeah. That's right. Yeah, exactly. And the first nutritional studies of Eskimos were undertaken in 1902 by August Krogh, who was the Danish Nobel Prize winner in medicine and physiology in 1920 or so. And he said, Eskimos were the most exquisitely carnivorous folk on the face of the earth because they ate protein, which was at that time considered five times what we would eat, in one day.
And we would also probably get sick if we ate that much, wouldn't we? Or we wouldn't be able to live on pure protein if...
Well, I'm not sure. One of the problems is the maintenance of what is called glucose homeostasis, and this is what runs the nervous system. And we manufacture glucose out of carbohydrates, but they were able to manufacture it out of protein. And I can't really go into much detail about that, but they were apparently able to do it.
And presumably still?
Presumably still, if they could get all that protein. But, as you know, protein is very expensive. If you go to the store and you look at how much steak is, you know, so much a pound.
But the protein that we're talking about is, I would guess, whale meat, seal oil. It's not...
Caribou, yeah.
It's not something you'd go to the store for.
Yeah, but the major problem, as you know, is a diminution of these resources.
I'm wondering, though, that it may be quite true or a valid argument when the Eskimo people say they should have precedence, they should have priority to what's left, because they biologically, by necessity, have to have the protein that they're accustomed to and that they can't get elsewhere.
Well, there's two ways of answering that. One is, in looking at human nutrition, what it involves are nutrients. And you can get nutrients from whales, you can get nutrients from walruses, you can get nutrients from the store. But what is of importance is the right choice of these nutrients. Now, that's one side of the problem. And one can say in a nutritional point, in a nutritional way, that they don't need whales. They can get that same nutrient elsewhere. However, there are factors of taste involved, and we all prefer certain foods over other foods. However, the whale is a very important animal to them in their cultural side, in the social aspect. And probably that's where the argument lies.
So they couldn't go before, say, the whaling commission or to some other body which makes the decrees on whales or hunting, that we need the whale because we need to live off the meat?
We can say, nutritionally, they don't need them. I mean, the nutrients from a whale. A whale is a whale is a whale. One whale, as far as nutrients are concerned, is the same as about 480 seals. Now, that's one way of looking at it. But nevertheless, a whale is a very important part of their culture. The captain of the whale boat, the umelik, is a person who has achieved status in the culture. Not only that, he's a hunter. And they can remember famous whale hunters. So the whole culture is sort of built around this, hunting whales. And if you do away with whales, what are they going to do?
Professor of Human Ecology, Fred Milan, of the University of Alaska. For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage, how things are and how they got that way. Chinook Patterns is information, issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life. Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller, and the subject today is Inupiaq. We'll discuss the state of the language and some of its characteristics with Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center. Inupiaq is the language of Alaska's northern Eskimos, and the language family extends across Canada to Greenland.
The state of Inupiaq language on the international level is flourishing when you take into account the Greenlanders, the Canadians, and the Inupiaq in Alaska. There are about 71,000 Inupiaq people, or Inuit people, in the world, and 41,000 of those are in Greenland, at least 18,000 are in Canada, and then there are about 11,000 in Alaska. The Greenlanders speak their dialect, which is called Kalaallisut, and a lot of the little children can speak it, and they use it as the instructional language in the schools, along with Danish. In Canada, when I was there last month in Eskimo Point on the west side of Hudson's Bay, Martha Aiken and I, a woman from Barrow, went there to attend a conference, and we were pleasantly surprised, or very happy to find out that the little kids, the two-year-olds, were speaking Inuktitut, which is what they call the Inuit language. And but the situation is quite different in Alaska, especially along the in the North Slope, and where the Inupiat language is at a very critical stage right now, and a lot of the young people, the children, do not know how to speak it. Some of them have understanding of it. They can understand when you talk to them, but they are not able to answer you in Inupiaq. And the schools have programs teaching Inupiaq as a second language, but no one has really measured the success of these programs yet to see if the students are beginning to use Inupiaq while they're playing or if the parents have taken up the practice of speaking Inupiaq to their children at home. And unless they do it at home, then no one sees the real success of the program in the schools for the where the children will begin to speak Inupiaq fluently.
How different are the dialects of Inupiaq, and I can't begin to pronounce the other the other two. Would you be able to understand somebody from Greenland?
Okay, just to give you an example, when I went over to Greenland about 3 years ago, I could speak with them or get my meaning across to them by using Inupiaq words. And if I was hungry or lost, and I'd say kaktunga or dammarunga, then I could make them understand me, and they'd be able to direct me to where I should go. But to hold a conversation with them, you know, like a running conversation, I was not able to do that for the first week or two. I had to get used to their different endings, but they have what we call a lot more assimilation of their consonants than we have in Alaska. And I had to get used to those sounds and know which consonants to assimilate. But when I spoke in Inupiaq to them, they could understand me quite a bit, because especially the older people, they said they could understand the words, the vocabulary I was using, and also recognize the endings, although I didn't assimilate a lot of the consonants.
When you go to Canada and Greenland for the conferences and things, what are you doing? What's your job?
The recent trip that I took to Eskimo Point with Martha Aiken from Vera was to attend a curriculum conference, and the emphasis was on the elementary grades, and they wanted to teach Inupiaq or Inuktitut grammar to students who already know how to speak Inuktitut. And I went there to offer my expertise on the Inupiaq grammar. And because we've done a lot of work here in Alaska, especially at the Alaska Native Language Center, doing research into the grammar of Inupiaq language. And what I did over there was to explain, my main emphasis was on explaining the demonstratives, which are unique to the Inupiaq language. And they're in Alaskan Inupiaq, Canadian Inupiaq, and Greenlandic Inupiaq. So, and a lot of the curricula that is being developed right now lacks this focus on the demonstratives, which are really unique to the Eskimo languages. Like there's a set of words which are called nouns in English, and then there's a set of words which are called verbs. And then in Inupiaq, we have another set of words which are called demonstratives. Well, there, if I were, like, for instance, we're in this room, and I want to refer to that light up there, but without using its name, then if I say, Pihinya, a person who understands Inupiaq fluently will look up. His orientation will be to look up and find something that is not moving, and that thing happens to be a light. Okay, but if there were a spider up there, and I said, Pahuna, then he'd look up and not turn his attention to the light, which is stationary, or to a dot or a nail up in the ceiling, but he'd look for something that was moving or either covered a long distance. It had great length.
And there are just a great many of these words then?
Yes, we have basically 21 stems. And for these demonstratives. And in English, I think you would call them demonstrative adverbs, because a word like uva translates into here, and it specifies a location, okay? But if I say una, then I'd be talking about something that was close to me, like a book or a cup, say una. And also I could extend the meaning of that pronoun and make it into a relative pronoun and say uma, this cup's or this one's handle, uma tiguvea. Okay, so they the demonstratives break into pronouns and adverbs as well.
Whereas in English, you'd just say that one, this one, here, there. It's not very specific.
No. The one word in Inupiaq would tell you what direction to look for something that is moving or big. And we have words like that which are related, like, for instance, something under the table that you couldn't see. I'd go samna. And your instinct would be to look under the table because that's a place that we can't see and it's underneath us. Okay. But if I said something like ganna, then you'd look down but focus in the area that you can see, not under the table.
That just, I guess, shows what is important to different people, that the distances, space, relationships, the visual cues are much more important.
Mm-hmm. You can apply these demonstratives to a house now, maybe to a two- or three-story house, because you can sit on the first floor, like, for instance, you have a basement, first floor and second floor, and use the same terms to refer to something upstairs, pamna, and something down in the basement, samna, you can't see it, and pamna, you can't see it because it's upstairs also. And you can also use it to refer to something in the porch, like sakinya, that you can that you've used in relation to the terrain, especially on the north slope where there's no mountains nor trees nor any big boulders to distinguish anything when it's during winter time. So a hunter would have to use words to refer to a direction, keeping his orientation to the ocean. So anything that was towards the ocean was like in the direction of down or inside. And anything away from the ocean, which would be pointing inland, would be up there, as well as up in the sky. So people had to orient themselves somehow and express that quickly. You know, you couldn't say you're standing on the ocean, you know, by the beach, and everything's all covered with snow.
You have to define.
And so that one down there behind the boulder and that tree, you didn't have those things to refer to.
So you have to have
a whole refinement of small degrees that are short, simple words that can be readily understood.
Yeah, short words which contain a lot of meaning. Yeah, so. But yeah, in the world of now the corporations, a lot of the terminology for shares and dividends and things like that come from the concept of dividing the whale up, you know. So you get a share, that's your ningik. Or when there's dividends and things like that, then you refer to the word, which may have been specified just for dividing an animal. Now the concept of a corporation, which belongs to all of the people, some of these same terminology is used, but just broadened. So
it must make the whole thing much easier.
It is much easier to understand. And in my teaching of grammar, I teach in Inupiaq at times, and what we do is we understand the concept behind that aspect, and then we put an aspect of grammar, then we put an Inupiaq name to it, and it sticks.
Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center. For Chinook Profiles, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.